This is the Context Podcast. Context Magazine is a publication of the American Sociological Association.
In this episode of the Context Podcast, we talk with John Bateson, who is executive director of a Bay Area Crisis Intervention and Suicide Prevention Center for 16 years. He also helped draft the California Strategic Plan on Suicide Prevention. He's the author of the book, The Final Leap, Suicide on the Golden Gate Bridge. And his piece, The Deadly Span, appears in the fall 2013 issue of Context Magazine. Thanks so much for joining us on the Context Podcast to talk about your new piece, which is on suicides at the Golden Gate Bridge. So why don't we start by having you give us a sense of what the scope of this problem is and what really attracts people to this location?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, the Golden Gate Bridge is the number one suicide site in the world. And in recent years, an average of 3 people a month have died jumping off the bridge, and 90 to 100 others have been stopped each year from jumping by the Bridge Patrol or California Highway Patrol officers. In August this year, there were 10 suicides from the bridge, which is the most in the bridge's history, and unfortunately the 10th was a 17-year-old girl. So since the bridge opened in 1937, there have been at least 1,600 confirmed suicides. Many others aren't confirmed, though, for a variety of reasons. Either the jump isn't witnessed, or the Coast Guard don't know to respond to the scene, or the body sinks and is washed out to sea before it can be retrieved, or it washes up on shore but farther down the coast, so the death can't be attributed with certainty to the bridge. So 1,600 is a very conservative number, but still it's far and away the highest number of suicides from any site in the world. As for why suicidal people are attracted to the bridge, there are a number of reasons. First and perhaps foremost, suicide sites do tend to develop an allure for people who are depressed. And there are a number of instances where someone has hanged themselves from a particular tree limb or beam, and within weeks other people have done the exact same thing from the same spot. And in that context, no site is more alluring than the Golden Gate Bridge, given its grandeur and the beauty of the surrounding area, and the long history of suicides. And then another factor is that suicidal people tend to be socially isolated. And if in life someone feels disconnected from others, by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, he or she may at least feel linked for all eternity with hundreds of other people who have made the same terrifying decision. Mm-hmm. And then there are the basic facts about a misperception that jumping from the bridge results in a quick, near-certain death with no messy cleanup, when in fact about 5% of bridge jumpers actually survive the impact and drown. But the main reason really is because it's so easy to do. The railing is low, it's only 4 feet high, yeah. Almost anyone can climb over it. So you don't need to procure a firearm or stockpile medications or learn how to tie a noose. You just need to go to the bridge and jump.
Right. Now, you say that the height of the railing alone means that there is likely a way that there could be placed a suicide deterrent on the bridge. But you say that people who oppose this give 3 different reasons, which is cost, aesthetics, and effectiveness. And in your piece, you kind of take apart each of these arguments. So could you walk through those 3 arguments and kind of what doesn't work with them?
Sure. The major weakness for the argument about cost is that the Bridge District has spent millions of dollars over the years on other public safety measures that end up affecting far fewer people. For example, about 10 years ago, the Bridge District spent $5 million for a barrier on the bridge to separate bicyclists from motorists, even though no bicyclist has ever been killed on the bridge. And just recently, the board approved $26.5 million for a median separating oncoming vehicle traffic, even though the bridge has only had 12 head-on fatalities in the last 40 years, and none in the last 12 years. There's an instance where a number of years ago there was a narrow 9-inch gap in the pedestrian walkway and a 2-year-old girl fell through it, an event that the general manager at the time said was the fluke accident of history. And yet immediately it was fixed. And all of these improvements have been necessary, and they were necessary in the interest of public safety. But in terms of the number of people impacted, they pale in comparison with preventing 1,600 suicides. Right. And then the final thing relative to cost is that currently the Bridge District has $125 million in reserves, so it's not as if money is a real problem there.
Yeah.
As for aesthetics, and this is an emotional hot-button topic, there have been a number of studies that show it's possible to design an effective suicide deterrent for the bridge that maintains the bridge's unique Art Deco styling. There's a suicide bridge in Toronto, for instance, that had a suicide barrier added, and afterwards the barrier ended up winning a National Design Award for architectural elegance. Many Canadians thought aesthetics were actually improved. And then perhaps more to the point, a lot of people aren't aware that for more than 30 years the bridge has had an 8-foot-high, 350-foot-long chain-link fence at one end of it. It's not attractive, but no one complains. It's also not there for suicide prevention. It's to keep people from throwing garbage on the visitors below at Fort Point. Effectiveness is probably the real key one. Many people believe that if someone is suicidal and they can't jump from the bridge, then he or she will just go somewhere else, so a barrier won't really make any difference. The fact is, though, and it's proven by research, that most suicidal people fixate on one means of death, and if that means isn't available to them, they don't resort to another means. Instead, they choose to live. Probably the best known example of this is a study by a UC Berkeley professor who tracked what happened to 515 people who were stopped from jumping off the bridge. And 25 years later, 94% of them were still alive or had died by means other than suicide. So only 6% went on to kill themselves. And to this point, there have been about 32 people who have miraculously survived to jump from the bridge. And nearly everyone has said afterward that it was the bridge or nothing. They didn't have an alternate plan for killing themselves.
A lot of our readership and listenership are sociologists or social scientists, and suicide has certainly been a major point of analysis. But a lot of the original studies and studies since Durkheim have pointed at the social context in which suicidal people come from, so their lives outside of the suicidal moment. And so your example kind of builds upon that by giving a different example. So how does your analysis or your example, the Golden Gate Bridge, kind of alter maybe what sociologists have traditionally thought?
Well, certainly the Durkheim's work regarding social connectedness or the lack thereof is relevant today. There are other factors, though, that are equally important when it comes to suicide in general and when it comes to the Golden Gate Bridge in particular. Some of those factors include a person's feelings around helplessness or hopelessness or a sense of being a burden to others that may add to their desire to die. And then there are physiological factors. New research is indicating that some people may have a genetic predisposition for suicide. There's also growing evidence that a person's lack of sleep may increase the likelihood of depression and could lead to suicide. All of these factors address the why regarding suicide, but they don't really address the how. It's not enough that someone wants to die. He or she has to have the capacity to kill themselves, which is no small feat in as much as the self-preservation instinct in humans is so strong. And one way to habituate yourself to death is by repeated exposure to it. Another way is by playing it out in your mind each time getting closer to the actual act. And when it comes to the Golden Gate Bridge, this can mean either going to the bridge multiple times before deciding to jump, each time perhaps looking over the short railing and imagining your fall in more detail, or it can mean going to the bridge just once, but walking back and forth repeatedly until a person works up the nerve to jump. A lot of individuals who aren't familiar with the phenomenon of suicide think that suicide is an act of cowardice, but it's actually an act of fearlessness. You have to get to the point where not only is your mental or emotional pain great, but you're unafraid to die.
You know, we hadn't discussed this a lot, but maybe you could tell our readers a bit more on your own experience working with people who are at risk of suicide, and then also kind of what you would like to see the broader social science community do in terms of researching or working on policies around suicide.
Well, my own experience with suicide came from the fact that in 1996, I was hired to be executive director of a 24-hour crisis center in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the agency operated a number of hotlines, including the county suicide hotline, so many people who contacted the agency were highly suicidal and needed to be talked down. The agency also ran an extensive grief counseling program, and some of the individuals in it had loved ones who had jumped from the Golden Gate Bridge. So I was in that particular job sensitized to the issue of suicide, but at the same time surprised in talking with colleagues, many of whom I considered quite well informed, and they had no idea that in our backyard basically was the number one suicide site in the world and the only major international landmark that didn't have a suicide barrier. So that's when I really started writing a series of op-ed pieces to try to educate the public about the problem in hopes of reaching a solution. And those op-ed pieces basically became the form or framework for the book I wrote. In terms of my recommendations for future study, one thing I would like to see is that relative to the Golden Gate Bridge and other bridges, I think study needs to be done on the efficacy of nets versus taller railings. In 2008, the directors of the Golden Gate Bridge opted for a net as a suicide deterrent, partly because it wouldn't impede views from the bridge, and partly because they thought a net would be cheaper to maintain than a taller railing. No other bridge that I know of has a net to prevent suicides, however, they all have taller railings. So it's a question of whether a net will be as effective. I certainly hope so. At the same time that they approved the net, the directors voted against using any bridge revenues to pay for it, so the problem continues. I think that there's a lot of work to be done, given the fact that the Golden Gate Bridge will probably become the model for future bridges around the world in terms of suicide deterrence, to really assess whether a net is as effective as a taller railing. I think in general with suicides, what really is a vastly understudied field, because it's so difficult to ascertain the information, is data on suicide attempts. All of us extrapolate from the little information we have about how many attempts there are relative to each completed suicide. A lot more work needs to be done to measure the hidden impact of suicide in our society. And I think once this is done, and people will see how pervasive suicidal ideation as well as suicide actions are, more efforts will be taken to really understand and empathize with people who are suicidal rather than blaming them. And work will be done to improve services to them and also reduce access to lethal means. Whether it's bridge barriers or safety locks on guns or blister caps on medications, whatever it might be. One of the things that's always kind of puzzled me is that we have laws in this country that regulate the addition of stop signs and stoplights at unregulated intersections after a certain number of accidents or fatalities have occurred there, but we don't have any laws that mandate that a suicide deterrent has to be erected at a bridge or tall building or freeway overpass or train crossing after a certain number of suicides have occurred there. And I think that is something that's desperately needed.
Right. And I think certainly a sociological perspective would be to sort of build a collective movement around an issue or to name it as a public issue is a hard part in getting policy to follow suit. So we do appreciate that you are framing this in a way that is understood well by people working in social science, but maybe not as well as on a practical level.
Well, and suicide is a problem that really transcends a lot of sectors. I mean, it's a sociological problem, it's a mental health problem, it's a public health problem, it's a public safety problem. And almost everybody knows someone who has died by suicide. And it's frequently hushed up because of stigma, which is another thing that absolutely has to change. And eventually, I think suicide will get to the point where, you know, perhaps AIDS and breast cancer are today. You know, 20 years ago, those two health hazards were stigmatized and treated as a taboo topic. And today, with increased public awareness, public attention, and resource allocation, we've made vast strides in reducing incidences of AIDS and breast cancer. And I'm hoping that in fewer than 20 years, the same success will be achieved relative to suicide prevention.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any other predictions on sort of what it would take to get to that step? Or is it sort of a wait and see?
Well, I think it's really a matter of educating people. There are so many misperceptions around suicide, and until people are comfortable talking about it and treating it in the same way that you talk about other public health issues, whether it's substance abuse or protected sex or domestic violence, whatever it might be, we really have to bring suicide out of the shadows and help people understand all the facets behind it before there'll really be a public movement afoot to really make changes in the way suicide is perceived, the way help is provided, and the way resources are allocated to help suicidal people find other options that will lead them to continue their lives and spare loved ones from the grief of their deaths.
And how about in terms of the Golden Gate Bridge as a specific site? Do you think that you foresee it kind of diminishing as a cultural landmark for suicide, or is that something it might be stuck with forever?
Well, I am firmly of the belief that the bridge is going to get a suicide deterrent in the next few years. The bridge districts did approve a net, as I said, in 2008, which was the first time in the bridge's history that they took positive action in the area of suicide prevention. And $5 million was provided for design studies and engineering drawings by the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. So the day is getting closer. I think money will be found either from MTC or perhaps from a match by the Bridge District, and construction will begin in the next, say, 2 to 4 years. Of course, that means that during that time, dozens more people will throw themselves off the bridge, and hundreds more families and friends will be grieving the loss of a loved one. Nevertheless, I do believe that sooner rather than later, the Golden Gate Bridge will join the other international landmarks that once were suicide magnets and now have barriers. And I believe strongly that when that happens, the bridge will become a monument to compassion as well as to beauty. And unfortunately, it's just not there yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are all the questions I have for you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. And your upcoming piece is in Contexts Magazine, which readers can find through the context.org website. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah. I really appreciate it. This is fair.